Good evening, listeners. It's January 27th, 2019, and you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday that can mean only one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Kristen Finch.
And I'm Maggie Exton. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests, and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight we are joined by Gina Moody, a master's student from Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies in the College of Liberal Arts. Gina is studying the effect of gendered language on perception with her advisor, Bradley Bouvy. Hey, Gina.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. Glad you're here. So what do you mean by, what is gendered language? What are we talking about here?
Well, mostly I'm talking about the ways in which people are trying to correct or enforce gender by using gendered language. A really common and well-known one would be boys will be boys. People will say that a lot to like excuse gendered ways people are behaving, if that makes sense.
Right.
Are any other examples you can... I'm sure there's so many.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There's so many. I think a couple others that I wrote down were like, don't throw like a girl. Another one would be like, sit like a lady. And then, of course, I think a lot about swear words, but we can't talk about that so much. So I'm trying to limit it to these kind of phrases that people will use, especially in childhood, but I think a lot later when people start growing up to say like, oh, women don't do that or men don't do that, and try and enforce kind of specific gendered ways people should behave.
Yeah, like good girl.
Yeah.
That's right. After we talked earlier this week, I was thinking of all of just in my everyday language, how much it just comes up and I don't even realize.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And as you said, some of the swear words are very gendered that we cannot say because we are live on the radio and that is not allowed during this hour. But so how are you studying the effects of these words and phrases on people?
Yeah, mostly I'm just asking people to tell me stories about when they've had these types of experiences, who's said these things to them, if they've ever used words like this or phrases like this to... And what was the purpose of that? I think that we could even say the word sissy on air, probably. So I'm thinking about, you know, when younger kids are saying, don't be such a sissy. Like, what are they actually trying to imply by saying that? Are they trying to say, like, don't act like a girl? Are they trying to say, don't act homosexual? What are they trying to say by actually using that? So I'm trying to dig into the roots of it in that way, purely based on experience and intentions. Yeah.
So how do you, you're saying you're collecting stories and you want to hear these stories. How do you do that?
Mostly I'm just asking people, have you had a phrase like this said to you? Some of the examples I give are going to be either swear words. Have you had these gendered swear words thrown at you? Have you had somebody say you're acting too girly or acting, you should be acting more manly? You know, what are these types of ways in which people are saying whatever gendered performance you're putting on is not appropriate or is appropriate for this situation or scenario? And I think that, like I said, a lot of this comes from childhood, but then there's a lot in work situations. There's a lot in school. You know, maybe girls shouldn't be good at math, and so they're often overlooked. So I'm trying to think of the ways in which language is contributing to disparities between genders, and especially in the intention that it is making gender binary, as well, to say that you have to be this way or you have to be this way and there is no in between.
Mm-hmm. And that it's bad to be in between or bad to be the opposite of how you maybe appear.
Or that there's no place.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That there's no place. And I think that especially terms like don't throw like a girl, if you're saying that to a boy, it's really saying like you need to perform in these expected ways of being a boy. And if you're not doing that, then you are a girl. There is no other place or category for you to fall into.
Yeah.
And so some of the questions on your survey, one of the methods that you're using to get some of the, or to take some of these stories down, is to ask questions also about kind of the setting of when these things happen. So what are you looking for in that case?
I'm looking for basically what are the power dynamics that went into this. So the setting could be at work, at school, in a peer group, in family. You know, who is the person that was saying these things, and did they have a certain influence or power over you saying that to you? I think that, you know, not all experiences are equal. And I think that if it's your dad saying it versus some dude on the street saying it, it's going to have a different impact. Right. So I'm going to weigh those things a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm. And then you also have in-person interviews where you'll kind of, I guess, get to dig a little bit deeper. It won't just be a supply answer type of thing. You'll get to ask follow-up questions.
Right, exactly. The questions are going to be very similar to the survey, but there's just going to be a lot more room for it to go where the participant wants it to go. So if you really want to talk about that one experience you had in eighth grade and talk about all of the situation that led up to that, or talk about how you're feeling about that now, if it's actually shaped the way you present your gender and you live your gender, that's where we can go with that. Or if you just want to talk about how you hate it when that happens, that's also great. So it's just going to be a little bit more free form to be able to speak longer about those experiences and see what comes out of that.
So who are you seeking to participate in your research? What's the demographic?
The demographic is anyone. They have to speak English because I speak English and I'm working with writing my thesis in English. So translating would not work very well. And they have to be over the age of 18 or the age of majority in their state of residence. So other than that, it's really open because I'm really trying to capture anyone, men, women, non-binary folks, trans folks, and then people, especially here in Oregon, I know it's majority white, but it would be nice to have other people outside of that or outside of kind of normative experiences come into play. Because I think that all of these things are interconnected if you think about the ways in which racism and sexism and homophobia are all interconnected to each other. I think they kind of compound and contribute to the ways in which we expect people to behave in their gender, if that makes sense.
So before we move on, can you give the definition of gender, what you mean in this case?
In this case, I mean how you perform and present to people and how you personally identify. So that means feminine and masculine or in between, or none of the above. But basically, I'm looking at whether or not you fall on that binary or if you don't fall on that binary and how people have reacted to that with gendered language.
Right. Yeah, I've heard people refer to gender now as a spectrum. I've heard it more and more frequently. And that idea that there's not just this extreme and this extreme.
Right.
There's all this in between.
Right.
And above and below and beyond.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I think that the ways in which we speak about it hasn't really caught up to it. You know, we have a lot of different labels, which is fantastic for people to be able to say, this is me. And I can find other people who are like me because they also are using that label. But in terms of like the gendered language I'm looking at, it really places people on that hard binary and kind of expects them to say, you need to be more feminine or more masculine because I assume you're presenting in this way.
So to do this research and in-person interviews and surveys, to work with human subjects, you need to go through certain precautions. Is that the right word for it? Or some format to make sure that everyone's consenting and safe to be in this research?
Yes, absolutely. Here at Oregon State, you have to go through an entire process called the Internal Review Board, which is anytime you're working with human subjects, be that just asking them questions about their personal life or collecting physical samples or working with DNA, whatever it is, you have to get this approval by the research board. So I had to go through that whole process, and they kind of tweaked things here and there to say, we don't want to put any of your participants at risk, either at risk of being identified too easily or at risk of any sort of harm. So we had to think about the ways in which people could be emotionally harmed or triggered or... the ways in which they might even benefit from this study as well was one of the factors to go into it. So my entire thing from top to bottom, the consent form, the questions, the ways in which I'll ask those questions has been laid out and looked at 10 times over.
Yep. With a fine tooth comb, make sure that the university is not going to get in trouble and you're not going to get in trouble for anything.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah. So how long was this process?
The process started in late June last year, so it's been about 6 and some months. And the initial feedback takes the longest for them to say, okay, yes, we're going to go ahead and like give you suggestions on how this study could be approved later on in the process.
Is there like a... kind of, it seems like submitting for publication, is there like a hard no in that first round, or is it always here, like you can tweak these things and this sounds...
There could be a hard no. If you're saying I want to interview children without their parents' consent,
okay,
that's probably going to be a hard no. So things like that in which it's like completely unethical, they would totally give you a hard no. In other cases where you're saying I'm working with people who can consent, and here's the safety measures I've put in place, they'll say, okay, I see what's happening here. We just need to make it more safe, more take it out of our hands to say we won't be put at risk for this as well. Yeah.
So I suppose working with people at a university, you were saying are considered a, what is it, vulnerable population.
Right.
And why would that be, do you think?
I think that if you think about some of the studies that have been done in the past, especially like scientific and academic studies, they have been on student populations in the first place, and they're considered an at-risk or vulnerable population because they're so accessible and because they are the main population in which researchers are going to target in the first place. And I think that institutions as well think of their constituents or students as vulnerable because they are part of the institution in the first place.
Yeah. So maybe they're participating in these studies all the time and could be affected by that, especially some studies that maybe are dealing with this gendered language or something that might have led to a poor experience in the past for this person, or I don't know. I was even thinking like, oh, if someone found out and my grades were affected by this or something.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's one of the huge things that the IRB process attempts to do is clarifies all of that language within consent documents, saying your grades will not be affected, your relationships with your teachers will not be affected, your status as a student here will not be affected, no matter what you say in this study and no matter what the effects of this study are in the first place.
Cool. cool.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to participate in Gina's study, she actually has a link out that we have posted on our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, and it is the newest post there. At the bottom, or in the middle also, you'll find the link to participate in the study if you're over 18 and English speaker and just have the time to give as much detail as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Because your survey was approved.
Yes.
It was approved.
We're live.
Yeah. Last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was just a week and a half ago, something like this.
Perfect timing.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and tell your friends, because you always need more, I guess, male participants especially, right?
Yeah. Cool. It seems to be that, I mean, I'll take anyone, you know, of course, as a researcher. I want anyone and everyone who wants to do this. But it's great to have a variety. And so far I'm seeing that there's a lot of women and non-binary folks that are willing to participate and not as many dudes.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to know, how did you get interested in looking and working with gendered language in the first place?
Right. That's a great question.
It may not have actually been like a single moment, you know. But.
Right. I think that one of the main reasons I became so interested in gender studies in the first place was because of some of these experiences I've had with gendered language in my life. And I think that as a queer woman, cis woman in the first place, I'd had to think about what those gendered phrases really meant to me, if I wanted to be a tomboy, if I was trying to fall outside of the gender binary, or if it was just in that I am queer, I was falling outside of that in the first place. I think that there's a lot of presumed heterosexuality that comes with these gendered phrases, especially things like, I think a lot about how you should act and perform femininity goes along with performing straightness as well. So that's kind of where it came from, was just my own personal experience in coming through and coming by these phrases in my life.
Mm-hmm. I find that a lot of folks, especially in the humanities at Oregon State that we talk to on this show and in other times, that they kind of, like you're saying, you are your researcher, or like your research has been strongly influenced by your personal experience rather than maybe interest in you know, some in like a
tsunami
applied in an applied field more right. So you know, more like an experience like you're talking about. But you had some experiences outside of the United States, and I was wondering if kind of any experiences there influence your research as well.
Right, exactly. I was just thinking about that because one of the things that I really started thinking about while I was abroad, I lived in Thailand where I taught English for a year and some, and then have been living in the Czech Republic for the past 3 or 4 years with my partner. And I noticed the ways in which people use English swear words and English vocabulary without context. And with context. So it was just especially ways in which, like, I think American English language has spread throughout the world and it's used so commonly. And especially the swear words, especially the swear words. So I kind of thought about that. Can you take away the power of words by not knowing their context? Or do they still hold that power to the listener? So that was one of the main ways I really started thinking about language. And then in terms of living abroad and seeing the ways in which you can kind of broaden the gender binary, I thought about how in Thailand there's a third gender recognized called the Kaituy. And quite a few of my students actually identified this way, and they were fantastic and flamboyant and really wonderful. But they're still not fully accepted by the society. Like, even though they're legally recognized as this gender, they're not actually able to wear what they want to work, or have hair longer than, you know, a certain length. So, you know, in the States, even though we do have this kind of strict binary, and we look over there and we try and say, look, this is more liberal. Well, it would be, it could be, but it doesn't necessarily mean it is that way yet.
Right.
Yeah.
So, your study, you're focusing, your participants, you're looking for people who speak English because you're focusing on these English phrases, but right. they don't necessarily need to be native speakers because this, right. This is part of what you're trying to look at is actually yeah. the cultural context of a native English speaker versus someone who is learning
right.
Maybe a little later on in life, or maybe they learned mm-hmm. it early on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's yeah. all pieces of the puzzle.
Exactly. So both in my survey and my interview, I ask, is English your first language? If not, what is? And if not, how long have you lived in a place in which English was the primary language spoken? Because I think that people who have had a smaller amount of experience with English being the primary language spoken are going to be... I actually don't know. I'm interested to find out. What is that going to mean to my research? And does it mean anything? Or are people going to come across these phrases no matter what? Like how likely is it that they're out there all the time already?
Yeah. And so why get a master's in women, gender, and sexuality studies? Because you can do these surveys? Like, because you want to do this kind of study?
I think that I mostly thought about what's going to keep me interested and occupied for 2 years.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to get a master's degree just because I like being in school. It's a comfortable space for me to be in and especially here in the Northwest where I grew up. But I think that being overseas and thinking about kind of like context and language and how that fits together and creates social space and really like forms cultural ideologies, women and gender and sexuality studies happens to be a place in which you're like so free to research whatever you want in whatever context you want without it necessarily being confined to it has to be a completely scientific study and have numbers attached to it. I think that they're just more free to say lived experience is valid and is research and is where theory begins. So that was the main reason I thought this would be a great place to do that kind of research in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Have there been other studies in the past that have done something similar? Like, I'm sure there's been a lot of thought about gendered language, but is this going to be new for our time and for our place?
I think that there's been a lot of studies on personal experience and personal, you know, ways in which we live in the culture that kind of has these strict rules of heterosexuality and binary gender roles, as well as I think I draw a lot from critical race theory that has done a lot of research on ways in which racist language affects people and actually contributes to, you know, difficult situations, life experiences. So I'm kind of pulling off of that and saying, actually, gendered language could do that too. But then I lost my train of thought.
Right. So I think what you're getting at is that, you know, if you're always hearing these words like girls aren't good at math or, you know, you're throwing like a girl, which implied that maybe you're not good at sports.
Right.
Then it's like reinforcing your idea about yourself. Like,
yeah,
you are a girl and maybe you haven't explored that yet, but you have this idea of what you're supposed to be, and then it's just going to keep affecting you and like maybe steering you toward this, you know, binary identity that maybe is not very clear for you.
I think that that's a big thing too, is the steering of your performance, of what you should be doing or should not be doing based on what gender you are or what gender you're presenting as. And I think that that's really restricting to a lot of people. And you can see that with the numbers of women in math or the numbers of men in art. And I think that there's a lot of people who are discouraged from what they actually love to do. And that's an issue in and of itself. But also I think that when you're saying, especially to a boy, like, don't throw like a girl, number one, that is implying that girls aren't good at sports. And number two, it implies you don't want to be a girl. So what is that actually saying to boys about girls in the first place? And yeah, all of that.
Yeah.
So what about after masters? What's next?
That's also a great question. I definitely, well, I want to be with my current partner, and he's in Prague. So I'm going to move to Prague and see what I can do in my field there. They have a gender studies program at their university as well. It would be nice to get involved with that or see what other kind of nonprofits and organizations are happening there to think about gender in the ways that we're thinking about it here, or to progress. Again, there's a gender wage gap there as well, to progress standing in society for people who are not men, basically, in the first place. So that'd be great.
Right.
So you also mentioned you're from the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
Where are you from?
I'm from Pullman, Washington, originally.
Okay. Did you go to WSU?
I did not. I went to Western Washington University and went to a tiny college called Fairhaven College that was very similar to a women, gender, and sexuality studies program, except for not quite so specific. It was a interdisciplinary liberal arts school, so you really got to pick and choose exactly what you wanted to study and combine those things into your own concentration and basically make your own major, which was fantastic.
Wow, I don't know if, like, as an 18-year-old, I would be able to... That sounds like a lot, you know? I guess there's some requirements that you need to have, but that would be hard to craft exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, it actually, I mean, it took me until my third year, which is when you actually have to solidify it and write it and say, what have I done up to this point? And what do I want to kind of be my main focus going forwards? And that's when I found something called somatic psychology, which is psychology of the body and the mind. In which I started looking at, okay, how is gender performed and how is it expected to be performed in our bodies and the ways we move and the ways we dress and act. So I kind of combined those two things and made a major out of it.
Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that is cool.
And so what was your major? What was the name of it?
It was called Gender Studies Through Somatic Psychology and Creative Expression. The creative expression was... lots of my own writing and photography and reflections on those sorts of experiences as well.
And did you have like a final project to seal it all, stitch it all together?
Right. Yeah. I put on a gallery showing of my photography in which I was trying to think about the ways in which bodies are interacting with spaces and places. And, again, kind of thinking about these combinations of how race and how gender and how class and intersections of identity are working together within specific locations. And the gallery was just fun. It was just fun to be like, friends, come see my artwork and see what I've been working on for a little while.
Yeah.
Was it nerve-wracking?
It was a bit. But Bellingham, Washington, where I went to school, has such a great art community. So I was able to find a wonderful gallery to put up my artwork and have it there for, I think I had it there for a week or two.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
So now in your master's, you've kind of got the other side of the coin, where, or no, maybe not the other side of the coin, but another slice of the story with right. gender, and another like perspective of how certain things about society are shaping who we are.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we're getting around to the end of our show, and we have two traditions that we always like to keep to. And so the first tradition is to ask you for your advice. And it can be for anyone. So tell us who your advice is for and what is your advice?
Okay. Well, my advice is for everyone, I think. And my advice is basically to think about what words you're using and who you're actually pointing out in using that language. And I think that it's so easy, especially with swear words, to kind of point as somebody as wrong. Swear words or ableist words and homophobic words, especially, to say, like, these bodies are wrong, these people don't belong, and a lot of these identities are invisible, so you don't know who you're saying it to or in front of. Maybe you're discouraging somebody from disclosing their identity in the first place to you. So I just think it's important to think about the language you're using and think about not only your intention in using that, but the effect that it's having on the people that you're speaking to.
Very good advice.
Yeah, that's great.
And very relevant to your
right.
study. And before our last tradition, I'll remind the listeners again that this is Inspiration Dissemination. We're talking to Gina Moody, and she is conducting a survey about how gendered language affects us. And you just go on, you look at the questions, give your personal experience to the best of your ability, and she uses that for her research.
It's anonymous.
Yes.
So we will hopefully from this learn a little bit about how these words that we use are affecting people, especially, you know, this sample of the population, at least. So with that, our next tradition is to ask you to provide a song as your outro to kind of close out the show. And so what is the song that you picked, and why have you selected it?
That's a good question. I picked this song. What is it called?
The Fog.
The Fog.
The Fog by Overcoats.
Okay, that's perfect. It was so foggy out today.
Yeah.
The Fog by Overcoats, because I noticed in this version that they say intersectional feminism is the future, and I thought that was so cool. And the Overcoats are just an amazing group in and of themselves, and I think it fits well with my theme and the theme of today and the outdoors. And yeah.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks so much, Gina, for coming on
Gina.
The show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And this is Inspiration Dissemination. We're a show we talk to graduate students every Sunday at 7 p.m. So tune in to 88.7 KBVR to hear more from graduate students, their stories, and about their lives in graduate school. Now we're going to play The Fog by The Overcoats, which was a request of our guest Gina Moody. And thank you all for listening, and thank you, Gina, again.
Yeah. Thanks. Take